In earlier times, when it still knew its own mind, it would run off for a little jaunt from time to time, stopping to hide around the corner and soak up the sun while its people were out looking for it, cursing. But those good times are over. Alone among all animals, writes the poet Albrecht Schaefer, the horse is tragic in its appearance. Tragic because it is completely dispensed with its freedom and its free will. The dog may have done the same, but at least that animal knows its purpose, to serve its master. The horse, on the other hand, knows that it would like to be free, but the burden is never-ending, and it is rarely allowed to run and has to stand there, even when it is frightened and when it is seized by the urge to return to its nature, to flee. It is trapped in eternal captivity, always overshadowed by an inescapable will to which it resigns itself without ever realizing. In Schaefer's eyes, the horse is torn like the hero of a Greek tragedy, trapped in a timeless bondage that forces it to defy its nature, its desire to escape and run. The will of the horse is broken, and not only its will. There may still be mares and occasionally genuine stallions, but, argues Schaefer, the real incarnation of the domesticated horse is the gelding, the stunted eunuch, in whom defiance and stubbornness, freedom and volatility, are no longer essentially active characteristics, but merely a memory. The dialectic at work here is certainly that of master and slave. But the horse is a servant whose master has no need to fear resistance or treachery. And yet, Schaefer continues, this animal held in perpetual captivity is seen by us as the epitome of all in nature that embodies nobility and magnanimity, stature, pride, and courage. The paradox that Schaefer puzzles over, seeing it as nothing other than tragic, lies in the situation of the domesticated animal that is so often put to work in contexts that are contrary to its nature and its natural instincts, but is also linked to the horse's double talent as bearer of both physical and metaphorical burdens, the object of countless historical tributes and attributes. This includes, not least, the countless predicates of nobility with which the horse is credited, beauty, purity, pride, attributes which have a certain hold on us, and this author is no exception. Nor did these qualities escape the many authors who contributed in their own small ways to give equine literature and iconography a veneer of glory and to make the horse a prominent object in the display case of our visual memory. Man has given dazzling roles to other animals in his worlds of desire and illusion. The lion can sing a throaty desert song or two about that. Instead of giving the dove the role of sexual maniac in the Garden of Eden, mankind has entrusted that naturally dense bird with a peace mission. Conversely, we have associated the often harmless, non-venomous, albeit vole-guzzling snake, with the Old Testament's general suspicion of malice. The horse, this creature with an infinite capacity for being sentimentalized, has long occupied an established position in the Almanac de Gotha of the animal kingdom. A supposedly peace-loving vegetarian with an attractive build and pleasant scent, its feces included, the horse stands for everything people see as beautiful, good, and noble, qualities which they like to imagine pervade their own nature. The horse has always embodied man's nobler side, his better self. For that reason, we cannot bear to see a horse suffer. This ennobling instinct has also erased from man's memory the fact that there can be bad-tempered horses. Indeed, this was common knowledge to horse connoisseurs such as Hans Baldwin Grimm, Hugo von Hofmannsthal, and John Wayne, as well as to that new recruit to the English cavalry who wrote to his bride that at the front and the back the horse was a very dangerous animal, and in the middle it was uncomfortable. In contrast, given the horse's constant nodding of the head, philosopher Otto Weininger reached the conclusion that an animal with such a penchant for saying yes must represent insanity. After a short comparison of the supposedly insane animal with the dog, though, Weininger was ready to concede that the horse was an intrinsically aristocratic animal, since it was very selective in its choice of sexual partners. The 19th century witnessed not only the starkest increase in the number of actual used-up and worn-down horses in history, but also strong growth in metaphorically weary animals. There was hardly a single idea that moved the century that was not in some way connected with horses. It began with an obsession of historic proportions, the worship of world historical individuals, Hegel, and the whole range of ideas associated with sovereignty and heroes on horseback. He continued through the notions of freedom and progress, up to images of fear and passion, not forgetting compassion, of course. It seemed as though horses could, and would, have to carry every kind of emotional burden, man's hopes and fears, his elation and lamentation. The horse is probably, after the human being, by far the most vividly described creature, and the one ascribed with an ever-growing list of qualities, the re-semanticized being par excellence. And then, there was always the enigmatic form that remained unmerged with all the written emphasis and paraphrasis. The creature of flesh and blood, the living metaphor, that wants to be loved, cherished, and cared for, and that we cannot bear to see die. The metaphor that can give us comfort or rip us apart with anguish. Tactile, furry, yellow, as tangible as the lion that appears in the flesh to the philosopher Blumenberg one night. In Florence, in the late 19th century, there lived a man who was particularly sensitive to the enormous impact of very slight details, such as the minutiae in a painting. Throughout his research career, he sought to make sense of the economics of human passions, insofar as it formed the idiosyncratic stuff of art. Abby Warburg, to whom art history owes the concept of the pathos formula, recognized even as a student that the painters and sculptors of the early Renaissance had harvested from the ancient world, particularly from sculptures and reliefs on sarcophagi, triumphal arches and pillars, these idiosyncratic formulae of body language with which antiquity conveyed such emotions as sadness, anger, or rage. Without concerning themselves with the archaeological origins or the ancient significance of the sculptures, the Florentine artists of the Renaissance interpreted them with a new vital and emotional dynamic, by which they often transformed a theatrically exaggerated and intentional pathos into a labored, mannered rhetoric. Touched, or even infected, by the excitement of the ancient formulae, artists such as Botticelli, Palaiuolo, and Donatello translated them into modern characters and contexts, such as elegant interiors. Reframing these formulae, they granted themselves all the license of a contemporary sovereign. They treated the ancient formulae, gestures, and means of expression as malleable morphemes with which new languages could be constructed. While the artists were translating the ancient inventory of emotional modes of expression, the pathos formulae, into a language of the present, they processed the stimulus, as Nicholas Luhrmann might have put it. And the horse frequently played a supporting role as the privileged second. Because the majority of the classical images that Warburg considered stemmed either from sarcophagi or triumphal arches and pillars, they were dominated by articulations of sorrow, of struggle, and of victory. Besides these, Warburg collected expressions of violence and sexual frenzy in mythical poses modeled by centaurs and maenads. In most of these scenes, especially those of struggle and triumph, the horse plays a key supporting role in carrying and conveying the tragic pathos of Greek mythology. The central figures are often, especially when it comes to the depiction of battles, composite figures of humans and animals, as mounts, while male-dominated scenes of violence have centaurs appearing as single-person hybrids and energetic ciphers, primordial symbols of female ravishing animality. Even Warburg's first seminar paper as a student of art history and classical architecture focused on the representations at Olympia and the Parthenon of battles between centaurs and lapiths, where the fascinated young student noted the animal strength with which the centaur grips his victim and the savage desire which even approaching death cannot stifle. Along with all the honorary titles awarded to him, Warburg can justifiably be credited not only with discovering a troubled, strife-torn, passion-filled antiquity, but also with rediscovering the horse as a privileged conveyor of the formulae of passion. Energy, knowledge, pathos, the three economies. Is it legitimate to explore them in isolation from one another? If it's a heuristic approach, or perhaps a simplification that we're after, then yes. But reality does not respect such divisions. Whichever way we look at it, we don't inhabit the world theoretically in the same way that we somehow cope with it in practical terms. Perhaps it's because we tend to underestimate the gravity of the somehow. When equine history is investigated in isolation and in all its contexts and connections, we see a constant overlap and intersection of economies and categories, which we might prefer, for the sake of theoretical convenience, to keep separate. But why should the connoisseurship of horse owners and breeders be any less dominated by passion than that of people who love beautiful women, operas, or collecting autographs? Are the practices of horse breeding not objects of the history of ideas as much as they are an expression of traditional empiricism? What are the artifacts of horse history, such as saddles, harnesses, and types of carriage, if not objects of cultural and anatomical knowledge in material form? As long as we go about trading, assessing, appraising, and comparing in the imminence of equine knowledge in stables, market halls, and libraries, it does not occur to us to divide up and classify the phenomena that are revealed to us fleetingly. There's a pattern here. We say this as a fact, a scientifically tested one, and that over there, that's just ideas or images or feelings. Instead, we process emotions and experience the charge of what we encounter as reality in very imprecise categories. We experience this flowing charge as here and now, a present tense that is at every moment shaded with values and tempered with emotions. Our ability to orient ourselves is based largely on instinct and our practical sense of the somehow or other. This does not amount to what the Marxists call false consciousness. On the contrary, we falsify reality the moment we shift to the mode that we consider theoretical and switch to the great distinctions such as res extensi versus intensi, things in themselves versus things for our sake, hardware versus software. But the astonishing thing about the history of horses lies precisely in the fact that it familiarizes us with an object, or rather a rich phenomenon, heavily laden with tradition that constantly circumvents the great distinctions or, as befits the species, jumps over them. This means that equine history reminds us again and again, in a gentle manner, and sometimes in a not-so-gentle manner, horses will be horses, of the initial stage of recognition, astonishment. Astonishment, not least about how heteroclite an entire huge body of knowledge based on centuries of empirical research and tradition can be, how impure and how true. For those who believe that knowledge is truer the purer it is, and the less emotional impulses are involved in the cognitive subject, equine history offers a lesson in realism. The idea of a pure science, Michel Serres once said, is pure myth. Readers and devotees of the Old Testament know that love and knowledge are not mutually exclusive. On the contrary, the same applies to the history of the horse. It, too, is full of impure knowledge mixed with love. Objectivity, the ascetic switching off of that which is sentient, touched, or excited, comes up against its natural limit, passion. The cognitive subject is supposed to eliminate itself? Tell that to an enthusiast, a collector, a connoisseur. No, a field of study interests us so much more when knowledge and emotion are intimately and inextricably linked. Herodotus. The gelding as a critic. Since the queen had little time to spare, the painter and his model agreed on a limited number of sittings. Although the project in question was a small format portrait, these sittings stretched over a period of 18 months, from May 2000 to December 2001. The portrait was not a commission by the royal family and, when it was finished, Lucian Freud presented it to the queen as a gift. He didn't want there to be the slightest doubt about his personal independence. Freud and Elizabeth spent the sessions engaged in lively conversation. There was no lack of topics, as both loved horses and dogs. Queen Elizabeth II has been a true horsewoman all her life, like her Renaissance namesake. Some of Freud's most impressive images show naked people surrounded by their sleeping or dozing dogs, but he also had a strong connection with horses. He began riding early in life, and later became a notorious frequenter of the racetrack and the betting shop, gambling away vast sums. Besides painting and his countless affairs, this was the third passion of his life. Several of the fleshy men in his paintings are bookmakers and shady figures from the turf. As a painter, Freud was a perfectionist. Sittings for a portrait could easily eat up hundreds of hours. The animals he painted also had to be extraordinarily patient, spending days in his studio, unless he chose to work in their stables, where he did indeed paint a handful of his great horse portraits in the last decade of his life. These include Grey Gelding, a portrait he painted in 2003. A photo from the same year, Plate 31, shows Freud leading his model to the well-advanced portrait on the canvas. Both protagonists, the painter and the sitter, are clothed in similar tones, somewhere between a dirty white and grey. The colour of Freud's hands is reflected in that of the horse's nostrils, while its brown leather bridle corresponds to the patterned silk scarf loosely looped around the artist's neck. But the partner look, shared by the two, is limited to garment and flesh tones. When it comes to art and its appraisal, the two go their separate ways. While the painter's focus is directed to the image, the horse turns its head away, its eyes closed, a look of disinterest or reluctance. There's no trace of the lively and jolly-looking animal of the portrait. In contrast with its painted image, the living gelding is playing dead. It is not the first time that Lucian Freud, grandson of the founder of psychoanalysis, has posed before the camera, creating a tableau vivant of a narrative, myth, or legend. We have a whole cluster of stories here, where the Pictor Doctus appears both as stage director composing the scene and in a cameo role as the subject. Two young scholars from his grandfather's Viennese circle, Ernst Chris and Otto Kurz, once collected and analyzed such narratives, and of course the grandchild of Sigmund Freud must have been keenly aware of the interrelationships at play between them. Chris and Kurz's focus was mainly on the short stories and anecdotes which emerged in the earliest literature on art given literary form by authors such as Plato, Xenophon, and Pliny, and later retold by Vasari. These placed the artist himself, his origins, his inspirations, and his talent at the center of the narrative. Especially popular were accounts where art was conceived of as mimesis, an imitation or mimicry of nature, and which conjured up fabulous tales of the animal subjects themselves, deceived by their own portrait, barking at their artificial companion, running away from it, or trying to copulate with it. "It is almost impossible," wrote Chris and Kurz, "to estimate the frequency with which this anecdote and similar ones occur. We already meet it in antiquity in a number of variations. A stallion attempts to mount a mare painted by Apelles. Quails fly at a picture on which Protogenes has painted a quail in the background. The painted picture of a snake silences the twittering of birds." It is almost as if Bernhard Grzimek, zoologist and behavioral scientist, in his experiments with animals and horses in particular, was inspired by the ancient literature on art. In the early 1940s, as an army veterinary surgeon in Berlin and in occupied Poland, Grzimek undertook experiments showing live animals, first a stuffed horse, then painted portraits, to see how they reacted to these dummies. The results would have delighted Pliny. The horses showed animated curiosity towards not only the stuffed animal, but also their painted counterparts. They looked at, sniffed, and touched the artworks and kept coming back to them. There was just one elderly mare who showed complete indifference, and initially, Grzimek thought that made her intelligent enough to see through the deception, until he realized she did not show any interest in her living companions either. The Grey Gelding, led by Lucian Freud to its portrait, is also either indifferent or hostile. Now, one might argue that this is not the first time he's been introduced to his portrait after all. As the model, he will have seen it several times throughout the process of its creation. In short, the horse is bored. Or is he responding as a critic, like the monkeys painted by Gabriel von Max? Is he expressing his displeasure at the portrait, intimating to the artist that he is not a second Apelles? Has the horse even recognized who is represented in this likeness? Has he recognized himself in the painting? It's a difficult question that should probably be answered in the negative. Not many animal species undergo the moment of realization experienced by a human child aged between 12 and 18 months, famously described by Jacques Lacan as the mirror stage, when, with a cry of joy, the child recognizes the other person as an image of itself. Freud's gelding might have been expected not only to show an interest in his depicted colleague, like Grzemek's horses, but even to experience his mirror stage in the presence of Freud's canvas and give a jubilatory neigh as if to exclaim, "Gosh, that's me." But apparently the intelligence of the beautiful animal does not extend quite that far. The study of animal intelligence has long moved beyond the stage of the experiments that 100 years ago accompanied the rise and fall of clever Hans. Today, horses are no longer required to learn to read or calculate square roots to prove their mental agility. Indeed, this dated concept of intelligence has been replaced by that of cognition. The field of equine cognition studies combines research into the physiology of horses, the functioning of the senses, the nerve cells, and the brain, with questions of ethology or behavioral science. From this deeper ethological understanding are derived recommendations for dealing with animals, advice which is often directly compatible with the teachings of writers of generations past, from Xenophon through to the English and French riding instructors of the 17th century, Cavendish, de la Guerniere, and which relies on gentleness and understanding of the animal rather than on compulsion and severity, as with the 16th century Italian school of Grissoni. The invention of the Turing machine by Alan Turing in 1936, the same year that Lacan coined the term mirror stage, which also involves a kind of feedback concept, and the ensuing cognitive revolution triggered by cybernetics have, since the 1950s, led to an impressive acceleration and differentiation in the way we explore how horses perceive their environment, how they interpret their sensory perceptions, how they interact with their peers, their environment, and other species, including humans. Research into the cognition of different species of mammals has overcome the divide that Descartes tore through living nature. For some years now, this field of study has even been undoing the double bond, which is so fiercely defended by philosophy. The association of consciousness with thinking, and thinking with language. Research into the evolution of human intelligence owes as much, if not more, to studies of the behavioral ecology and cognitive ethology of monkeys, dogs, and horses, as to human psychology and ethnology. The horse, for 6,000 years our primary mode of transport, is still a great conveyor of knowledge, our friend, our companion, and teacher. Besides behavioral ecology and cognition studies, the search for fields which offer the most potential for equine studies now and for the future also brings us back to archaeology. Many regions and cultures of the world have a history only because of archaeology. This includes the regions to which all horse cultures of history, from the Arabian to the American, can trace their roots. The vast areas to the north and east of the Black Sea and Caspian Sea, and the huge landmass of Central Asia. For the historical events and evolutions in these parts of the world, researchers have very few written sources at their disposal, among them Herodotus's histories. Finding evidence of the ancient history that stretches much farther back than the use of writing, the history of the colonization of these territories, the establishment of sovereign states, the birth of countless languages, and the invention of hunting and war techniques, all relies on patient prospecting by archaeologists. This includes breakthroughs in paleontology and historical zoology over the last 50 years regarding the early history of the coexistence of humans and horses. Historians who have studied the history of people in the period over which equine history extends, such as the medievalist Hermann Heimpel and the historical theorist Reinhard Koselleck, have registered the tone and the unusual tension that history acquires as soon as they broaden their field of observation to include an awareness of the horse. As Koselleck recognized, the horse was an outstanding agent of modernization. Without the horse's role in the dynamics of production, circulation, and warfare, it would have been much harder to usher in the wave of modernization in the late 18th century, the notorious saddle period, and it would certainly have developed differently than under the circumstances in which horses met the demand for kinetic energy. On the other hand, as Hermann Heimpel strongly reiterates, horses represent bridges to the past, offering a connection to the time of Charlemagne and beyond to the earliest periods of humanity's history. Horses link the man of late culture, as formulated by Heimpel's contemporary, the philosopher Arnold Gehlen, with the primitive man who had first domesticated the animals. Horses were not only agents of modernization in the most recent period, beginning roughly with Napoleon, They were also agents de liaison, connecting us with the earliest stages of that realm we call history. During this entire period, horses have been our companions, our fellow travelers, and fellow sufferers. Indeed, in retrospect, it almost seems as though they have enabled something like solidarity between modern man and his Neolithic ancestors. Do the nodding, snorting creatures, pawing at the ground, not place us side by side with the inhabitants of Botai and Arevka? Together with man, horses opened up the realm of history. And at the point when it looked like it was all coming to an end, from the point of view of conservative thinkers, equidae and human parted ways. Meanwhile, we've put the theories of the end of history behind us, and history, instead of ending silently or disappearing into the archives, has certainly marched onwards, albeit more generally without horses than with them. However, our perception of history has changed. It seems at once both to have expanded spatially and to have shrunk chronologically over time. On the threshold of modernity, as the many histories of the ancient world found their way into the collective singular of one history, the geographical expanse of history was still largely focused on Europe and Asia Minor, and limited culturally to the realm of the written word. The pre-literate peoples and regions of the world were, by definition, ahistorical. Since then, the scope of history has continually expanded to encompass the globe as an entirety. The modern techniques of historical epistemology, which owe much to archaeology, ethnology, and paleobiology, and other precise scientific fields, have blown open the closed doors of philology and textual criticism to such an extent that possession or non-possession of a written script is no longer a deciding factor for having a voice in history. The scope of history, which until relatively recently could still be thought of as a closed solar system, where everything orbited around the deeds and woes of those peoples who possessed a system of written chronicling, found itself suddenly expanding to encompass the larger evolutionary contexts of pre-literate humanity, of animals, plants, landscapes, and continents. The image of history, as it had been taught until very recently at school, suddenly looked crumpled and shriveled, rather like Max Ernst's Europe after the rain. Although history has responded to these challenges, much remains to be done. When looking for new ways to think about history and describe it, we ought not to overlook the oldest approaches. Perhaps, after all, it is time to read Herodotus again. Hardly any other author of ancient literature has become as topical as the incomparable chronicler from Halicarnassus. No matter how far and wide the narrator of countless legends traveled, or how much he saw with his own eyes, whether he truly fact-checked his stories or simply made most of it up, he did at least, like very few who followed in his footsteps, raise his head above the parapet of all-too-human history. Herodotus, who felt the sting of exile 4 centuries before Ovid, also shared with him a love of spinning a yarn and a firm belief in the gods and the fates. He collected trusted tips for gold mining, relying on giant ants or young girls with feathers, and meticulously noted the wedding rites, mating customs, and death cults of the peoples he encountered. He tells of the horse oracle that brought Darius to the throne, and of the Scythians' custom of burying their rulers together with their horses. Stallions and mares, as he knew, had lead roles in the cast of history. They lent sovereignty to kings, and were interred alongside them. Posterity has been both kind and cruel to Herodotus. He has been praised as much as chastised. His detractors would expose him as a writer of fiction, or criticize him for his Hellenocentrism. It cannot be denied that he sometimes described the life and customs of the peoples on the fringes of the known world rather as an entomologist would describe the impulses and appetites of a rare beetle. But perhaps his anthropological myopia is less significant than his hyperopia with regard to the natural and preternatural. Perhaps, rather than protecting Herodotus against his critics, we need to defend him against his admirers. His devotees included in particular humanists, such as Wolfgang Schadewald, who in his Turbingen lecture praised the father of history, Cicero. Herodotus, he argued, was the first to understand that he was dealing with all these things as they have occurred at the hands of people, and thus with history as one great people occurrence. So, did he see Herodotus as the inventor of history, as the cosmos of humanity, an early precursor to Giambattista Vico? But what if a modern-day reader were to find contemporary relevance in this ancient author in the very fact that his field of view was not restricted to mankind alone? In fact, one should read Herodotus for other reasons, as endorsed by late humanism. From him, we learn the art of a compelling historic narrative with not only human protagonists as its subject, but also stones, clouds, and gods. And, indeed, horses. History is acquainted with many different actors. Some are huge composite bodies, composed like an army of dozens of divisions and thousands of men with tanks and typewriters, while others are minuscule and inconspicuous, like a pill or a cloud of microbes. Some live 1,000 years, others a mere couple of hours. Ultimately, historians must decide for themselves whether to allow horses more space in the scenes they conjure up of the past. Horses are, after all, just one species of historical actor among many. When we consider the significance they took on over time and what they achieved in their alliance with mankind, we have to admit that they were a very special kind of actor, particularly fast, particularly steeped in history, and particularly beautiful. Herodotus was astute in seeing this. A horse passes on. Westphalia, after the Second World War, was anything but an island of the blessed. The impression of peace, the memory of the 19th century, these were but mirages. The forests, where the last remaining units of the Wehrmacht had been surrounded by the Americans, were full of discarded or superficially buried weapons and crates of ammunition. Despite being strictly forbidden, we country boys sought out and found in the woods the toxic moraine heaped up by the war. We compiled our own secret arsenals, and occasionally someone would blow himself up with his stockpile. My grandfather knew what we were up to and kept mum. In a drawer in his workshop, he had 2 battered bullets from an aircraft machine gun. An English fighter plane had shot at him and his horse when they were out ploughing in March 1945. He was hurled into a furrow, and the animals bolted, but by some miracle were all unharmed. As fascinated as I usually was by tales of the war, this was one story I did not like hearing. The smashed-up bullets, encrusted with soil from the field, sent a chill down my spine. One of the 2 horses from then was still in my grandfather's stable. I could picture the look of terror on his face and imagined what it would have been like if he had been hit, the sudden burning and the blood on his dun coat. I pictured how he would have lain in the field, helplessly trying to rear up in his harness while still hitched up to the wooden plow and the other horse, the actor in the network, dying. I did once see a horse writhing in its own blood. It was a slender brown mare named Cora, one of the most beautiful animals I ever rode as a child. My mother would take her out hacking in the week while her real owner, a building contractor from the nearby city who had come into some money, was off managing his diggers and building sites. Gentle-natured, with something of a sense of humor, Cora used to get up to mischief from time to time. She had a pronounced tendency to leap over the fence of her pasture when the whim took her, to go and have a little explore. On one of these impromptu outings, she got caught up in some barbed wire, which a farmer was about to use to replace the fence around his sheep's field, and had left lying on the ground. The mare lay on the ground, the tendons of both front legs lacerated, her dark brown legs covered in blood, looking around wildly, her eyes full of a desperate plea for help. The forester, who was passing by, a former sergeant in the Wehrmacht, offered to shoot her, and a village policeman, alerted by the neighbors, proposed the same solution. It was the intervention of her owner that saved the injured mare's life. By the evening, he had arranged for her to be transported to what was then the most sophisticated veterinary clinic in the area, where Cora was carefully nursed back to health after weeks suspended in straps. When fully healed and back on her feet, she returned to the farm and resumed her old way of life in her field, with her fences slightly increased in height. But the look of that desperate animal, the blood on the grass and the voices of men, all talking about shooting her, continued to haunt my dreams for a long time to come. Who can bear to see a horse in agony? The horse, that tragic animal, the sight of its death is unbearable. Its long legs buckling as it sinks down to its knees. The slow collapse of its great body. The broken look in its eyes. Nobody can bear to look upon it. Horses are killed like soldiers. If too severely wounded, they are given the coup de grace. But they are not gassed. And when this did happen, in Flanders in the First World War, it was unintentional collateral damage, as we say today. Man reserves gassing for his own kind, and for insects. The sight of suffering animals chisels through the armor of the toughest soldier. I felt sorry for the horses, not the people, but I felt sorry for the horses till the very last day. There's hardly any reportage from the two world wars, barely a diary or a letter, without an expression of lamentation for the horses. Did Goethe not feel the same? The badly injured animals could not die in peace, he wrote, of the campaign in France, with a vivid description of the sufferings of the mortally wounded and cruelly mistreated animals. It seems, remarks Marlene Baum in her analysis of Goethe's Poetics, as though the suffering inflicted by this war is exemplified and dramatically portrayed through the horses, as we find remarkably few corresponding examples of human suffering. For 1.5 centuries, it seems, from Goethe to the Second World War, the suffering and death of horses was actually something of a formula for pathos, a means to convey the suffering of war per se. It provided a symbol for anyone who wished to enunciate the widespread suffering, but felt unable to voice that of their fellow man. But even those who wanted to shout their indictment loud and clear, like Picasso when he painted Guernica, could not do so without the image of the horse. In a concise, almost taciturn scene, barely longer than a page, Thomas Hardy describes the death of a horse. One night in May, in the early hours of the morning, the young Tess Stubblefield is driving home on the narrow country roads of southern England, her sleeping brother beside her in the wagon. The old gelding Prince up front pretty much knows the way by himself, so Tess closes her eyes, not noticing as she dozes off. Woken by a sudden jolt, she hears a hollow groan, sees a black mass on the road ahead, and knows that something terrible has happened. The groans are coming from Prince, speared by the pointed shaft of the silently oncoming morning mail cart, piercing his breast like a sword, and from the wound, his life's blood was spouting in a stream and falling with a hiss into the road. Tess, in her despair, tries to close the wound with her hand, which only results in her being splattered all over with blood. Then she stood helplessly looking on. Prince also stood firm and motionless as long as he could, till he suddenly sank down in a heap. Tess's father refuses to sell his old horse to the knacker for a few shillings, and so the body of dead Prince is buried in the garden the next day. The shadow of the dead horse looms over the young Tess for the rest of her life's journey. I'd never seen a horse die, but I did know one that for a long time was closer to death than to life. It was a large, strong draft horse, a Belgian stallion, a young animal of impetuous temperament and tremendous strength. That is, until the day in June 1954, when, while out mowing a meadow surrounded by a stone wall that had warmed up in the sun, he stepped on the tail of a sleeping adder. It was the last reported sighting of a venomous snake in these valleys of southern Westphalia. Since then, it's thought that there are only harmless grass snakes and slow worms in these parts. The last adder of Westphalia flared up like the devil and bit the stallion in the chest. The horse managed to get back to his stable unaided, then stood in his box, more dead than alive, swaying, but unable to lie down. Too weak to eat a handful of oats, too feeble even to drink some water. For 4 weeks, this heavy animal stood, sickly, miserable, poisoned to the very tips of his golden mane. Even the vet, with all his experience of large animals, doubted he would survive. The owner would wake in the night and go to check whether his horse was still alive. The stallion, this mountain of a horse that seemed even bigger at night than by day, stood silently in his stall, swaying and staring into space with dull, clouded eyes. After 4 weeks, the animal gave a deep groan one morning and, at the sight of the snake bite, the skin of his breast burst open, and from the putrid wound out poured a gush of dark pus, several buckets full of wound exudate. The stallion moved, and slowly, still dazed, he allowed himself to be led out of the box, into the open, where he stopped again, dazzled by the light, and too weak to take another step. He had survived. This has been a Highbridge production. Read by Matthew Waterson. Copyright 2015 by Verlag C. H. Beck, Offener Handelsgesellschaft, München. Translation copyright 2017 by Ruth Ahmedzai Kemp. First published in German by Verlag C. H. Beck, Offener Handelsgesellschaft, München, in 2015, under the title Das letzte Jahrhundert der Pferden, Geschichte einer Trennung. This translation, first published by Alan Lane in 2017, under the title Farewell to the Horse, The Final Century of Our Relationship. Recording copyright 2018 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.